Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of October. Before we get rolling on today's hour, thank you to the more than 9,000 people who contributed during our Half the Time pledge drive. We have raised almost all the money in half the time, which is just extraordinary. It's not too late to pledge and help pay for the programs you count on each day. Please pledge now so we can completely make that goal at WPR.org, or you can still call 888-202-2889. Well, there were huge demonstrations all over the world, protests that started, well, it's hard to know exactly where they started, but they are everywhere right now. United for Global Change, which is the central site for the movement organizing worldwide protests, said 951 cities in 82 countries took part in the demonstrations after online organizers called for a worldwide rally. One of the largest, 10,000 demonstrators gathered peacefully in Madrid. Around the world, protesters marched, listened to speeches, and displayed banners reading anti-corporate slogans, including the now ubiquitous "We are the 99%, banks are cancer, and tax the rich 1%. Today's New York Times has a display of some of the placards that were seen in New York, and one perhaps says it all: "I am very upset." This hour of the program, we go to Italy, where there were demonstrations and they turned violent over the weekend. Our guest is Professor Pepper Culpepper. He is a professor of political science in the Department of Political and Social Sciences at the European University Institute. His research focuses on comparative political economy, processes of institutional change in democratic capitalism, and the quality of national democracy in the European Union. He's the author of a number of books, most recently Quiet Politics and Business Power, Corporate Control in Europe and Japan, which explores the role of political salience in determining the power resources of actors in battles over takeover regulation and executive compensation in Europe, Japan, and the United States since 1990. He's also author of Creating Cooperation and Changing France. He's a former Marshall Scholar at Oxford University and has had long-term visiting appointments in France, Germany, and Japan. And I love to say that. I love it when people speak so many languages. He speaks English, French, German, and Italian. He will speak to us today from Italy in English. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Culpepper, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. Well, what is it that would draw this many people, 951 cities in 82 countries? It strikes me as pretty phenomenal.
Well, it is. And I guess, what is it? You said in your intro, lots of people are very upset, and they're upset about different things, but it's pretty easy to frame the protest right now in a protest of on an inequality frame as is going on in the United States, or against capitalist regulation gone awry, which is more how it's going in Europe. And, you know, in Europe, the backdrop is against the whole crumbling or apparent crumbling of the structure of the euro, and a question rising again, you know, who's going to be bailed out, and is it going to be the banks, or is it going to be the real economy? And so There are a series of perceived injustices and perceived problems with how democracy handles these injustices over time that lead to a lot of discourse between what's going on in Europe and what's going on in the United States. And if you ask those protesters, many of them anyway, they'll say, in response to your question, when did this start? They say it started in Tahrir Square in Cairo.
I see.
They see a pretty straight line running between, at least the organizers do, between what happened in Egypt with protests for democracy and what happened with the occupation of the public squares by the indignant ones in Spain, Madrid, Barcelona, and elsewhere, and now the more recent Occupy Wall Street and its European manifestation.
Have we seen a real change in the concentration of wealth all over the world in the past, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, so there are fewer and fewer people making the most money?
Well, I don't quite know how to answer the question because there's been an explosion of wealth happening in other parts of the world that didn't used to have wealth, notably China and India. So on the one hand, I think the answer is probably not. But in terms of the distribution of that wealth, particularly in the United States, but also elsewhere in the industrialized countries, there's been a move towards those who have benefited most are those at the very top of the income distribution. And this, particularly with the we are the 99%, is a claim about the lion's share of the gains have gone to those at the very top of the income ladder in the United States. The income inequality growth has not been that extreme anywhere in Europe. It's been somewhat extreme in Britain. But there's a general feeling that political processes are running in favor of the very moneyed interests, and it's particularly striking in the United States because of this strong sense of how many of the gains that we've had from technology and technological change are going to a much smaller proportion of the economy.
You're joining us by phone from Italy, where the protests were somewhat violent over the weekend. Tell us about who gathered in Italy and why they turned violent.
Well, I think the answer is that the same people gathered in Italy who gathered most places throughout Europe anyway, and probably also in Wall Street and elsewhere, and that is predominantly young people, but a smattering of people whose interests were raised by the frame of the protest, by their discontent with what's going on, both with the political solutions and their ability to even exercise political voice in the process. In terms of why they turned violent, there was a big protest in Rome, as you mentioned, and it essentially turned violent because there were a relatively small set, is my understanding, of anarchist organizers who went in with the intention of turning the protest violent, and those who had organized the protest, intending it to be relatively peaceful, were then unable to stop the anarchist protesters when they came in and started, because they came in armed to have a violent protest, and if peaceful protesters are going as violent protesters win one-on-one. And so you had these outbreaks of violence. And then, you know, Italy, there was something in the Corriere della Sera about, well, once again, Italy is the shame of the world the next day, because this was supposed to be a day of peaceful protest. And I think a lot of those protesters intended it to be a peaceful protest. But, you know, it just depends who comes to the party. And there were some people who came to the party that were interested in peaceful protest here.
Yeah. And is there something peculiar to Italy that we should know about? How are people faring in Italy? What's the employment rate like? What's the regulation of banks like?
There's a lot going on in Italy right now. There's a government that's widely perceived as being unable to do anything. And indeed, it's essentially a three-party coalition led by Silvio Berlusconi, who I think is even well known in the United States.
Yes,
the richest man in Italy, who controls all the news outlets, the private news outlets, and he's combined with the former fascist party from the south and what's called the Lega Nord from the north. And what brings this sort of ungainly coalition together, because in the north, this is mainly small business people who want to avoid paying taxes, and in the south, the National Alliance is largely people who are dependents of the state and therefore dependent upon tax income. You have a coalition that's unable really to do anything about fiscal consolidation, which is what Berlusconi said he was going to do, and it's unable to do anything about getting Italy moving again, because Italy's had substandard growth for the past 10 years, and southern Italy is like eastern Germany. It's one of those places that's extremely underdeveloped in the context of an advanced country, and so not only do you have high unemployment in Italy, you have it concentrated in these pockets in the south, and now Italy is one of the countries that international markets, international bond markets, that is, are starting to look at as a place they should make a run on, and no longer want to lend money to Italy and therefore put it into crisis, and thereby putting the European Union into crisis, because, well, anyway, it's a longer story, but essentially the Italian bond market is much bigger than something like the Greek bond market, when Greece defaults, it's a manageable situation, but if Italy were to go into that sort of situation, it would not really be manageable with the resources available to the European Union. So there are internal problems of ungovernability, and there are external problems related to what's going on in the European Union that make the Italian people particularly sour right now as to what's going on in politics.
And are you fearful? We've had guests say in the past, as we've tried to analyze this, that the European Union is in trouble, the Eurozone may be in trouble, and if that goes, watch out.
Well, I'm not. I probably am in the minority of observers in that I think the eurozone won't go, but I think that the eurozone won't emerge in 5 years with all the members that it has now, and in particular, I think Greece. Eventually, what will be found is a way for Greece to exit the eurozone, because Greece can only really adjust if it's able to devalue, and it's not able to devalue locked into a single currency. So it would be good for Greece. It would be good for the eurozone. But the question is, how do you do that? Because if Greece goes out and Greece defaults, because Greece's defaulting is inevitable, that creates problems for the banks who sold bonds to Greece, which is French and German banks. And so French and German banks have been lobbying to bail Greece out. And so the question becomes the technical one of how do you protect the rest of the eurozone when Greece eventually has its default, and whether it stays in the eurozone or out of the eurozone, how do you keep that sort of wave of contagion from spreading to other members, to Spain, to Ireland, to Portugal, and to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that happens, then you really have a very unpredictable situation.
Professor Culpepper, where is all of this going? It just seems remarkable to have all these demonstrations everywhere in the world. What happens a month from now or a couple months from now? How are leaders all over the world? They have to be talking about it. What are they thinking?
You know, I don't even think I could tell you what's going to happen next week, frankly, because things are moving very fast. The
right.
European Union is having a summit this weekend on Sunday, and they're right now trying to play down expectations of there being a magic bullet to emerge from the summit. But essentially what bond markets want to emerge from the summit is for them to come out with what Hank Paulson several years ago called a very big bazooka, and that is to say mobilizing enough money that markets believe that everything is stable and that Greece's default can be handled and the rest of the eurozone will be okay. Because the whole market question is is one about what do I believe everybody else believes? Because if I believe everybody else thinks the markets are stable, well, then I'm willing to lend money to government. And if I don't, then we have a credit crisis on quite a quite wide or global basis, because if European banks start going down, well, those European banks they have holdings that are relevant to American banks. And so that's why the United States has been telling Europe to get its house in order. And, of course, Europeans haven't taken very kindly to that because they don't think the United States has its house in order either. So what will eventually happen, I don't know. And I think it's very hard. I think anyone who tells you they do know, beyond the fact that Greece will definitely default, is probably just giving you a low probability estimate.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Our lines are all filled. Our guest is Professor Pepper Culpepper, and he joins us by phone today from Europe. He is a professor of political science in the Department of Political and Social Sciences at the European University Institute. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Tuesday, the John Carlos story. John will be joining us. You'll recall, some of you, and some of you will learn about this moment in history for the first time, the 1968 Olympics in Mexico, as the Stars and Stripes ran up the flagpole and the national anthem played, Smith and Carlos from the United States bowed their heads and raised their fists in what was described across the globe as a black power salute, creating a moment that would define really the rest of their lives. There was a lot more to their actions on the medal stand than just gloves. The two men wore no shoes to protest black poverty, and they wore beads around their necks to protest lynching. John Carlos will be with us to talk about that moment and the moments preceding and following that moment, hour number two. Let's go to phone calls. Dan in La Crosse is our first caller. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I think what and this is more of maybe a comment than a question, but there's an emerging global elite, I think, that you see out there that really doesn't seem to have any real loyalty to any particular country or region. You see these folks, they're willing to relocate in the United States, companies from state to state to get the best deal, and also move their companies overseas to save a few nickels. And I think the perception among folks is that these are the kind of people that will push their own grandma under the bus for a nickel. And I think people are rightfully angry at them because they're manipulating the system for their own gain and really hurting a lot of other people.
Professor Culpepper.
Well, I think that that is indeed a widely shared perception, and it's probably true. And what I think makes people especially angry is that there's a perception that many of the governments are catering especially to this emerging global elite, because this emerging global elite controls a lot of the finance. I mean, if a government wants to borrow money, who do you think it has to go to? It has to go to international markets. And so you get finance ministers making treks to PIMCO, this big bond trader, to say, well, here's what we're going to be doing, and here's why we think you should lend us money at 6% and not 7%. So I think that there has, to a certain extent, always been a global economic elite, but what's new about it, as I think Dan pointed out, is this footloose character and less of a tie to a nation state than there was before. And on the other hand, you get governments of nation states all doing the same thing, trying to cater to this global elite, and that creates a lot of unhappiness politically. And we don't really have suitable political channels for that unhappiness right now. And I think that's a big part of the protests that you're seeing in Europe and in the United States.
And what about the global elite? What are they after? Is it too simple to say they just want to make a whole lot more money and greed is a motivating force? Or do they really believe deep in their hearts that they're doing the right thing to help people get by on day-to-day salaries that are a lot less than theirs? What is it?
I'm probably not the person to answer that question, but I think that greed is not wrong as an answer, to be sure. I think that there are members of this global elite who actually have a great deal of concern for having some sort of regulation, but they have a strong commitment to markets that commitment to markets is indistinguishable from the fact that their being free and open markets is a very good thing for them and has allowed them to make lots of money. And so the fact is that there's an agreement among elites about the amount of regulation that there should be that is not shared by many people who have not shared in the bounty of global markets to the same extent. So to some extent, you can say these are people saying they want deregulation because it helps them. But on the other hand, I think many of these people actually really believe this, but they don't see the political problem of where deregulation has not brought progress. And so there's a little bit of disconnect there. So I don't want there's good reason to demonize many of the people who are part of the global elite, but many of these people are not people motivated solely by greed, but they see the world differently and they see regulatory solutions differently. And they have disproportionate influence.
David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, hey, morning, Kathleen and Professor. You know, my question would be, I hear a lot of advertisements on many of the radio stations advertising the brand new financial product to get us out of this past problem. And I'm just wondering if these new financial products are like designer drugs. If you're familiar with the war on drugs, if you had a specific formula for one kind of drug, if you manufactured a slightly different version and it wasn't on the law books, then you could essentially sell that drug until they came up with a law to deal with that chemical. So along those lines, are these new financial instruments essentially the new form of scam? Are we essentially trapped in some sort of a cycle in which the previous laws are only good for a specific design of a corrupt practice?
What kind of financial instruments are you talking about, David?
Well, I just listen to a lot of, the corporate chain radio stations, and they're advertising, get out from a bad mortgage by buying our new, call us today, we'll get you a new financial product that will get you out from your bad mortgage. And so it really seems to me that there's a pattern and practice of trapping people in an ongoing series of bad loans. For example, maybe your guest could answer this. If I understand right, after World War II, the interest rates on VA loans were, if I remember right, it was 1.5% for a mortgage. And even in places like Utah, they had usury laws so that the mortgage rate could not be any higher than 0.7%, not even 1%, 0.7%. And the Missouri had usury laws of 7%. And during Jimmy Carter, the roof was just lifted, and mortgages got into 16%. If I understand right, they actually went to 22%. So the states never prosecuted the violations of the usury laws, and that started this tidal wave of financial instruments that have essentially looted the baby boom and created this current crisis. And so now, since the U.S. district attorneys and the state attorneys have not been prosecuting these violations of usury laws, it's created this ongoing looting of America. And if I remember right, Bank of America actually sold 10% of its shares to the Sultan of Dubai. So now we've actually got monarchs owning America. And owning many of the mortgages in America, at least 10% of Bank of America's mortgages. And so we're ending up with kingdoms owning America. And so if the prosecutors are not going to prosecute, and we're going to end up with financial instruments that are false and designed for looting as opposed to designed for economic stability, then we are not in any kind of normal economic situation. It's more like an organized crime manipulation of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Professor Culpepper.
Well, there are a lot of issues tied up in David's very interesting comment. So let me try to speak to the broader issues. I mean, because I think that the major fount of outrage with the character of the financial industry is the essential belief that for a long time the role of the financial industry within society, if you want to give it a societal function, was to allocate capital efficiently. And there was the belief that it did this more or less under a certain regulation that prevented it from doing things that were too risky. And at a certain point, there began to be huge innovation in the character of financial products available, notably with securitizing mortgage markets, because that's when you could take mortgages and then you could pass them on to a seller, and then you started slicing up the mortgages, and then you get CDOs and CDSs and things like that. The very complex financial products, which, to be very crude, allowed for large-scale gambling on markets, allowed for people to take out big insurance policies against failure for a house they didn't own, right? Because they were just basically betting with the insurance product, not using the insurance product to insure themselves. And lots of people made lots of money doing this. But whereas before you could see very clearly with the link between my bank making loans to people in my neighborhood in order to allow them to buy houses and being responsible to them because they weren't going to loan money to people that weren't going to pay back, You get a breakdown of that contract. And to look at where people are seeing the financial industry now, they're saying, so you get paid so much because you bring society what? You know, you don't see, we don't have Occupy Silicon Valley. Everybody
right.
knows what Steve Jobs is doing, what he was doing, and what Apple is doing, and what other companies like that are doing that create products that people actually want to buy. There are people who want to buy these esoteric financial products that are the backbone of the mortgage market that was being discussed. But they're essentially the global elite that we're talking about that are moving large sums of capital around and gambling on it. And so I think there's not a coate set of demands associated with these protests, but one of the questions that's emerging is, you, financial industry, are receiving huge returns, and what is society getting from you? And I think that question remains to be answered, and I think that's a lot of what mm-hmm. what lies behind David's question. He did say one thing that put me a little bit back when he said that it talked about the ability to borrow looted the baby boom. Those people like me who really consider themselves born after the baby boom feel like the baby boom looted us. So there's also a generational element going on here, that is, people who were inside the baby boom years enjoyed all the benefits of economic growth for that period and then had good pensions for a long period now. Those of us in succeeding generations, and for my children it'll be worse than it is for me, see a problem of there's not that same thing, and why do we not get that deal? And that's exactly why you get so many young people in these protests, because a lot of these protests are about, you know, the social contract was about we work for capitalism and capitalism works for us, and now we only see the first part of the equation happening.
Right, and they can't find jobs, and they're working three jobs, and they've been described as a lost generation, moving back with mom and dad, many of them having to put their careers that they spent tens of thousands of dollars developing on hold, and maybe on hold forever because you can't enter a field when you're in your 30s when you've done something completely different for 10 years. It's very hard for them.
That's absolutely right, and there's sort of a feeling of despair, right? So what is in this for me? I thought I was going, I being an individual young person, I was going into education such that I could come out and be a productive member of society. And so I come out, and you see this particularly in the United States where people come out with huge college loans, and then there's no place for me to work. What social contract is that? And so there was a growth system that worked from 1945 to 1973 very well, and then worked less well from 1973 to 1990. And since 1990, there's been a whole new character of changes, and it appears that one of the losers of those changes are young people.
Yes. David, thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about Occupy Wall Street and Rome and London and Melbourne and the huge worldwide demonstrations that took place over the weekend, and thought we would bring in one of our favorite guests from Italy to talk about what this worldwide demonstration means, if it's different in every country, where it goes from here. It's still in a stage where it's being formed, but it's fairly massive and means to you, what does it mean? 800-486-8655. And the email, you can use that if you want, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and we go next to Rich from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Professor. I was taught in school that capitalism works, that it's a risk-benefit analysis that you engage in. You make sensible decisions, and you make tremendous sacrifices. And you build a community within capitalism. Business people make tremendous sacrifices. They take risks, and if they think rightly, they succeed. If they think wrongly, they fail. Capitalism depends upon failures in order to sort out what is good from what is bad. It does not depend on being too big to fail and turning to little people, that is taxpayers, and aggregating their resources and saying, you have to help us out. The message of the protesters is very simple. The game is rigged. It shouldn't be rigged because, as the professor has already said, if we break this social contract between the generations, and between, I'm sorry, but I'm going to use the word, the classes of people within the United States, we are courting revolution. And maybe the revolution is needed. Maybe it will only be in our thinking. However, the protesters are correct. This game is rigged. The taxpayers have bailed out the big guys, and the big guys are now complaining that the protesters are whiners about the system. This is ridiculous.
Pepper.
Well, I pretty much agree with Rich in his characterization. Maybe where I differ slightly is, are we courting revolution? Because the question then is, it's unquestionable that this is exactly the problem that many of the protesters see, and many people who observe the protest sympathetically see that. Well, what does it mean when heads up you win, tails we lose? That doesn't seem fair, right? And that's the perceived deal that the banks are getting because they get bailed out when they take risks because they're systemically important. individuals aren't perceived as systemically important, so they just lose their houses, and that somehow doesn't seem fair to anybody. Now, there's a very good argument for why you want to stop financial contagion, of course, and anyone can see that argument too, but there's a moral economy to capitalism as well as a political economy, and so the moral economy is part of what seems out of whack. So what are we courting? I don't know what we're courting, because it's unclear. These protests signal to me something that I've already perceived elsewhere, that and I'm not alone in this. This is me and 200,000 other people who look at the problem, see that political parties, as well as organized interests like unions, don't seem to be channeling interests the way that they did, and to bring them together into workable coalitions that then fit problems into the political system. And so what one of the characters of this protest, as I understand it, is to say, we don't fit. We, the protesters, don't really fit into any model of this system. Now, everyone is, of course, trying to instrumentalize their protest. And so the European elites are saying, we stand in solidarity with the American protesters against the failure of regulation on Wall Street, because it's costless for them to say that. They don't say anything about their own regulatory problems. And then Barack Obama says, look, I stand entirely with Occupy Wall Street. But he stands with Tim Geithner and Larry Summers when it comes to Wall Street, too. And so that's a different situation than the one in which many of the protesters find themselves. So what we have is we have parties and political institutions that don't really channel this, and we have protesters who are angry about it. But will they, if they don't find an outlet, go to revolution? I don't know. I don't know that they will. I think that they can go to demobilization and dissatisfaction with politics. And I think that that's actually a much greater source of undermining democracy than revolution would be, because people are frustrated with the ability of government to deliver anything to them, and they lose faith in these institutions, and so there becomes an organized hypocrisy about the institutions, and that's what a lot of non-democratic systems looked like for a long time, that supposedly the advanced industrial democracies had beat that problem. So, again, it's a highly uncertain area.
What makes it so darn difficult for government to respond to this great anxiety that people are having? Why can't you figure out how to get people jobs? Why can't you get that social contract in terms of housing and health and other things fixed? Why is it that the government simply seems to not respond to any of this? It's understandable why people are upset with their government, because the government's not doing much. They just seem inept.
I don't know if there are easy solutions to be had, and I don't know that government is doing nothing. But what is clear is that government is pulled in a lot of directions by various groups that have an interest for things to be the way that they are. When public anger gets very high, as it has, for example, and one of the flashpoints of this particular protest is the case of executive pay, where executive pay has gone back up, and this is one of the things that I've studied, government does respond. Government responds almost in a Pavlovian way by, when people are really angry, that's when they finally produce legislation that responds to what people want. And so you get, with executive pay regulation in Dodd-Frank in the United States, a whole new set of issues that very much the people in Wall Street wish had not passed. So there is responsiveness. But this is ineffectual, and it's ineffectual because there are not social organizations that stand behind in the boring process of implementing policy and making it happen and fighting day-to-day boring committee meetings to make laws that are on the books actually have the teeth that they need to have. And so I think that the problem why government is not responding is that government sometimes tries to respond, but on the one hand it's pulled by interests. On the other hand, we have an organizational base of civil society that is out of sync with the demands of regulation at this point.
Oh, that's
out of syncness makes it hard for government to be responsive in the medium term.
Mm. We'll talk more about that executive pay situation down the road here. Rich, thanks for the call. Let's go to Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello to your guest. I have a couple things, and one that just came up, but it's relevant to the show. First thing is, on Facebook, maybe you had noticed, but the past couple weeks there was a young boy who just posted that he was a college grad and basically said he was living within his means, but he did also say that he was not part of the 99%. And looking at a lot of the responses on that, they were very broad. It struck a chord with a lot of people. Some people praised the young individual, saying, this is the type of son I want to raise. And some people I know were very critical because he thought he's not living in the real world. He doesn't know yet what it's like to have insurance and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And I think when I saw the part of, when you said, I'm not the 99%, what did make me a little critical of was, I don't know if he understands, well, what the protesters are really protesting about, because I think there are many that were protesting that actually are very well off and are doing well, but they're protesting because they see this upper elite not being held accountable for bad decisions that they made. This is in regards to the bailouts and what have you. And then just my second point, it is relevant to the program, but a different. How would the guest maybe compare the Occupy Wall Street movement to the Tea Party? And would there be any indication that somehow the Tea Party or elements of the Tea Party might in its own way go global? And I'll take my comments off.
Thanks, Boyd.
Well, those are both interesting questions. So the I'm not one of the 99%. I was probably a college student like that or a post-college student like that because, if you're 22 and you just got out of school and you have an education and you feel like you're going to live forever, you don't necessarily want to subordinate yourself into an organizational movement if it's not speaking to your particular passions of the moment. So on the one hand, I can see that, but on the other hand, it's hard to see if you think about the general distributional problem, what the college student is actually talking about, because the distributional issues have become so extreme in the United States, and maybe maybe it's appropriate. That's the system that everybody wants, but we haven't had an open debate about the extent to which the gains are going to the very top. In the United States. And so having this open debate allows people to decide whether being one of those 99% matters or not. So that would be the way that I would think about that response. But it's again, part of the general problem of the movement that 99% is not a get-everyone-fired-up slogan, because it says, well, you're just part of the great mass, too. And we've always had a problem talking about class in the United States, and it sounds like now we're going to be the lower class and the 1%, and maybe 70% of the United States will think it's of the 1%, like they used to about the middle class. The Occupy Wall Street versus Tea Party question is a very good one. Sid Tarrow, a Cornell political scientist, has written about this recently in Foreign Affairs, and he says, in a way that I find very, very persuasive, no, they're not the same sorts of movements, because the Tea Party, we know, was actually, we have polling data on who these people were politically before they became Tea Partiers, and they were always associated with the Republican Party, and indeed the mobilizing part of the Republican Party. So there's a sort of constant stream there of what they're trying to do. Whereas, as I said, I think this protest is much more saying, and Tarrow has a line saying, we are here. That's the kind of protest this is. We are here. Pay attention to us. Maybe we'll disappear and maybe we won't. But that's a much more resonant message globally, and certainly in the advanced industrial countries, than is the Tea Party message, which is very specifically tailored to what is perceived by parts of the Republican Party as overreach in the United States. The sort of overreach that makes the Tea Party angry makes people in the rest of the industrialized world shake their head, because everybody's got some sort of a nationalized health care except the United States. Mm-hmm. So they don't understand what the debate is about.
Pepper Culpepper is our guest this hour, professor of political science at the European University Institute. We are asking the question this hour, why are a lot of people all over the world very upset? 800-486-8655 is the number. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, it's been almost 43 years since Tommy Smith, the son of a migrant worker, and John Carlos from Harlem took the medal stand in the 200-meter dash at the 1968 Olympics and created the most enduring, riveting image in the history of either sports or protest. We will be talking with John Carlos, the second hour of our program today, who's written a really interesting book. Professor Pepper Culpepper is with us now, joining us by phone from Italy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 is the number. Lee in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Lee.
I wish I would have done what the protester did 20 years ago. I had a good job, but yet it still wasn't enough to support my family. So the banks and the rich, I'll say, stereotype them, I'm sorry, the rich Republicans convinced me to go into debt. And that is what's ruined our country. And one of the things I regret the most in my, I'm 62 years old, is that at one time I was a card-carrying Republican. I'm ashamed to say that, but I was. And I got into the party, and I seen how they use and abuse people. The very rich in the Republican Party don't care about anybody except themselves and the money. And that's what they're doing with Mr. Cain, I'm afraid.
You think this is a Republican thing, or is it not really dependent on party affiliation, Professor Culpepper?
I would say that there is a concentration in the Republican Party of people who have a strong commitment to there being little regulation and little redistribution. And so that doing that sometimes requires that you convince people of policies that, so in other words, having low taxes and not having a big welfare state requires that you convince people that they can make it on their own, that making it on their own is indeed the sign of individual valor, and that the system is not rigged against them. But isn't the system wonderful because it leads them all these possibilities where they can borrow money and provide all the consumer goods that they can't afford, that they would have been able to afford 40 years ago when they had a better paying job. So to a certain extent, that is concentrated in the Republican Party. With parties of the right as well. I don't want to say that everyone in the Republican Party is of ill will, because they're not. Some people believe this is the best way to do things, and that if you actually bring in a welfare state, they think that what that does is that actually is going to inhibit growth and it's going to create more unemployment, and that's a bad thing. But certainly you're going to get a concentration of the sort of view saying that, you know what, it's better if we don't do redistribution through the state because the individual always knows best. But I will say that in the Democratic Party, there was a strong move also as an individual right to expand access to consumer credit. And expanding access to consumer credit meant allowing lenders to give you money in more punitive terms because you're a higher risk person, because you're a higher risk of default. And so a lot of people got into trouble trying to keep their levels of consumption up when their wages were going down because of this openness of credit, which was not uniquely a product of Republican deregulation, but also of a move in the Democratic Party to make consumer credit more widely available as a way to compensate for the failures of economic growth to provide its returns to everyone.
And didn't the Democrats have a moment where they could have made a huge difference? They had a choice of listening to either Elizabeth Warren or Timothy Geithner?
Certainly President Obama had that choice. The character of our political system is such that there are moments when change can happen.
Right.
And the immediate post and in financial crisis moment that President Obama inherited was such a moment. And my reading of that is that Elizabeth Warren was nowhere close to the halls of power when it came to making the big decisions about how the financial industry would be restructured or mm-hmm. not, and that Obama decided, for good or ill, that he would defer to who he judged as being the smartest guys in the room, Summers and Geithner, and so those two guys had an inordinate influence on the policy that was eventually adopted.
Thanks, Lee, for your call. Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Andy.
I think Kathleen, that the reason for this global, people being globally upset, there's no question that, the too big to fail and the fact that they became too big to fail and didn't fail, all right, has got a lot of people upset, and that's obvious. But the fact of the matter is that today technology, okay, technology combined with very bright people, combined with finance, all right, is quite global, and it creates the ability to make really significant amounts of money. Our firm deals with these people, all right, internationally. And the fact of the matter is that these people are, for all intents and purposes, the brightest. I mean, they simply know more, they understand more. The average American, and for that matter, the average person around the globe, their understanding of finance goes no further than their checkbook. But the reality is that there's a huge, there's a huge business out there that's very closely tied to the ability to make large amounts of money. The average person and the people protesting around the world, they're simply not tied into those occupations. And so you have this significant kind of disconnect going on that resulted in too big to fail. All right, they should have failed, but they were in fact too big to fail. And now people are beginning to see how they're disconnected from the reality of this, in quotes, global elite, who, by the way, are not that greedy. They just simply use money as a barometer of their success. They're very driven. The one thing these people all have in common, highly talented, very ambitious, and hardworking.
Professor Culpepper.
I think Andy's right about that. And if I'm not mistaken, it's in 13 Bankers, the Political Economy of Crisis book by Simon Johnson and Quack. It looks at what happens to the U.S. economy when smart people are in various industries, when the high human capital is going into particular industries. And one of its findings is whenever you get a concentration of the smartest people, so the graduates of the Ivy League colleges disproportionately at the end of their 4 years saying, well, what I want to do is go work for Goldman Sachs, going into the finance industry, you get a crisis shortly after that. Now, this is sort of an ideological point for them to make, but I think it is worth pointing out, as Andy did, that these are bright people who are very driven and who think that these are the incentives the system gives them, and so can they help it if they're smart and they go in and play the game and they win? And I think that's why you get these kind of perplexed answers from Wall Street of what are they upset with us for? We just made it. And so when you have human capital, which is the most valuable asset in today's economy, then it seems to you like, well, this is great. I can't believe I can go out and make this much money doing this. These people don't understand what they're buying, and I can sell it to them. There's a problem with that, of course, if the net social output is not increased by your innovating in all those products. And so that's the disconnect that you see between the individually smart but collectively stupid outcomes.
Yeah, and there's a problem with it if you have broken that basic social contract and you're getting bonuses.
That's not what they see. They see, well, I didn't have a social contract. I had a contract. Here's what my contract said, and my contract said if I brought returns to my company over a certain amount, then I should be handsomely rewarded. And if my company decides not to reward me to somehow be a model of social virtue, well, then I'll go work for another company. I'm not saying that's right. Indeed, on some level, I think it's deeply twisted. But that is the character of the mindset inside the bonus culture. And so This is why companies don't want to respond, because companies use bonuses to incentivize all that hard work that Andy was talking about.
Yeah. We don't have time for another call, I'm sorry. But just briefly, if you can tell me in 30 seconds, we just did a show on how great things are in Germany. Why are people protesting in Germany? And I think we also think in Canada things are better. And there were protests there, too. What's going on there?
Can't speak to Canada, but certainly in Germany things are better than they were. There's still it's still a lot harder for young people to get transitions to good jobs that used to be a sort of expected thing. And moreover, there's still a great amount of discontent among the young people, as with the political establishment, with the extent of deregulation in the United States. And so you've got the German Social Democrats coming out and saying we need to go back to some sort of Glass-Steagall Act in the United States, because
right.
We've got to restrain finance.
Thank you so much for being with us. Professor,
my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you and get a world perspective. Professor Pepper Culpepper joining us by phone from Italy. He is in the Department of Political and Social Sciences at the European University Institute, where he's been for a couple of years now. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. And thank you, everybody, for participating in this hour. We'll be on the subject again. Rest assured.